Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, we've been discussing the Maha Sakaludai Sutta. This is Sutta number 77 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And last time we started to speak about this sutta, and the sutta opens when the Buddha meets with the wanderer Sakaludai and his group of fellow wanderers. And Sakaludai reports to the Buddha that just at this time, all of these famous teachers, these six so-called outside or heretical teachers, and their followers have all assembled for the rainy season in Rajagaha. That's the major city in the state of Magadha. And last time I went through briefly the views or doctrines of these six heretical teachers. And along with the six heretical teachers also gathering in Rajagaha, there is the Buddha himself. And the text compares, or Sakaludai compares, the six heretical teachers unfavorably with the Buddha on the ground that the Buddha's disciples always live in dependence upon him and they honor and respect him, whereas the followers of the other teachers don't always respect their teachers. Okay, now we come to paragraph 7 in the sutta. And now after Sakaludai again reports that the recluse Gotama is honored, respected, revered, and venerated by his disciples, the Buddha asks him, what are the qualities that you see in me because of which my disciples honor, respect, revere, and venerate me? And Sakaludai says that he sees five qualities in the Buddha because of which his disciples respect him. Okay, first I'll mention what these qualities are. And we have to remember that these are the qualities from the standpoint of somebody who is outside the Buddha's fold. These are not the qualities that, as we'll see from the sutta itself, these are not the qualities that the Buddha's own followers really see in him, by reason of which they respect him. Okay, first, Sakaludai says that the Buddha is one who eats little and commends eating little. Then the Buddha is content with any kind of robe and commends contentment with any kind of robe. He is content with any kind of food and commends contentment with any kind of food. Content with any kind of resting place, as any kind of lodging, dwelling, and commends contentment with any kind of resting place. That's meant by resting place. It's the kind of place where an ascetic would live. Generally, ascetics, wandering ascetics would live often just out in the open air, or just in little huts that are built to shelter them for the night. Sometimes the foot of a tree, they have to live at the foot of a tree. Okay, again, the Blessed One is secluded and commends seclusion. Okay, so we have eating little, contentment with any kind of robe, contentment with any kind of alms food, contentment with any kind of dwelling place, and seclusion, resorting to seclusion. So all of these, if we take a look at them all together, we see that these are the kind of qualities that would be embodied by one who represents primarily an ascetic, an austere, ascetic way of life. So by fastening upon these qualities, in a sense, Sakaludai and others are projecting their ideal upon the Buddha. And in India, in that period, this would have been something of the ideal of extreme asceticism. And we know that this was, in a way, precisely what the Buddha rejected when he discovered the middle way. The Buddha did retain an emphasis on certain ascetic qualities within his own teaching, but he did not emphasize carrying these to an extreme. The Buddha did allow the practice of certain ascetic, the undertaking of certain ascetic practices to be taken up by his own followers. And in Buddhist tradition, these come to be called by a particular name. I don't think the name occurs within the canonical texts themselves. They come to be called Duttangas. The word Dutta, it's derived from a root meaning to shake off or shaken off. The idea seems to be that by undertaking these practices, one shakes off defilements, attachments. So the word dutta means shaking off, and anga means a factor. So duttanga are factors, literally factors of shaking off, but they actually mean factors of ascetic practice. They're also called dutta dhamma. These are ascetic practices. The Buddha's disciple, Venerable Mahakasapa, was praised by the Buddha for being the disciple who was the foremost in the Dutta Dhammas, the foremost in the ascetic practices. And Mahakasapa, amongst all of the monks, is the one who represents most distinctly the old ascetic ideal, which is still preserved to some extent within Buddhist monasticism. But the Buddha himself moved away from that old ascetic ideal of extreme austerity towards one of moderation. Okay, within the Visuddhimagga, we have these various ascetic practices collected into a set, the standardized set of 13 ascetic practices. Some of them include, okay, taking only one meal a day. Of course, for monks, the rule is not to take food after midday, but most monks will take two meals a day. But one ascetic practice is to take all one's food just at one time. Another practice is to go to take food exclusively that one obtains by going on alms round, not to accept invitations to meals from householders, not to take food that's provided inside temples from the temple kitchen, but to go to get all one's food by going on alms round from house to house. Then there's still a more austere practice of going on alms round, also included as a separate dutanga, and that is to go on what is called uninterrupted alms round. We call this maybe non-discriminatory alms round, which means that one goes from one house to another without making any distinctions, without discriminating, without thinking, oh, these people regularly give, these people don't give, these people give good food, these people don't give good food, these people are devout and respectful, these people just give very casually without proper respect. These people are poor, these people are middle class, these people are well-to-do. But and one goes in alms round, one just selects a certain area, and then one just goes to every house, standing in front of the house. If nobody comes to offer alms after a minute or two, one just moves on to the next house. With regard to robes, one practice of the one of the ascetic practices was to use only robes that are made from scraps of cloth, pieces of cloth that one finds and that one sews together oneself, not to accept a robe that is ready made. We'll see some of these ascetic practices as we go along in the sutta. Okay, so let us go on to paragraph 9. Okay, the Buddha now is going to show why Sakaludai's reason for the reason that Sakaludai gives for the Buddha's disciples honoring him are not the proper reasons, for if we take these reasons and follow them through to their conclusion, then the Buddha's disciples should respect and revere other monks more than they respect the Buddha himself. Okay, so if the Buddha's disciples honored and respected him because the Buddha eats little and commends eating little, then the Buddha says, there are disciples of mine who eat much less than I do. They live on just a cupful or half a cupful of food. A bilva, you don't know what a bilva fruit is. This is, I'm trying to think of the equivalent. It's about the size of a grapefruit, perhaps. A large one could be the size of a small grapefruit, or sometimes the size of an orange, that quantity of food. And maybe it's about the size of an orange. So they eat each day just a quantity of food equivalent to the mass of an orange. Well, the Buddha says, I sometimes eat the full contents of my alms bowl or even more. Okay, so if the Buddha's disciples honored him because he eats little, then the conclusion would follow that they should honor, respect, and revere those of his disciples who eat a very small quantity of food rather than the Buddha himself. Okay, if the Buddha's disciples honored and respected him because the Buddha is content with any kind of robe, then it would follow that they shouldn't give first place to the Buddha and respect him as being the foremost teacher, because there are disciples of the Buddha, other disciples of the Buddha, who follow these ascetic practices regarding robes. Okay, some of these are what they call refuse rag wearers. This is called pangzu kulika. That means that they collect these rags or cast off pieces of cloth from different places, from the charnel ground. That is when a person dies, they take the body and they wrap it in the old cloth and they cast it off into the charnel ground. Okay, and some ascetics, when they're looking for cloths for making robes, they go to the cremation ground, the charnel ground, and they pull this cloth off from the corpse. And then they use that cloth to make their robe. And we would think, ordinarily, we think that's a rather repulsive way to make one's clothing. But they will take this cloth, wash it in the river, and then cut it up into patches, into pieces of cloth, sew them together, dye them, and make the robe out of it. Or else they collect pieces of cloth from the rubbish heap, from shops, from the streets, from different places, and they sew them together to make their robes. Well, the Buddha says he sometimes wears robes that are given by householders. These are robes that are ready made. Already the householders cut up the pieces of cloth. According to the regulations, the robe has to be made from pieces of cloth that are cut up and sewed together. But when householders do it, they will employ tools for cutting up the cloth. They will use tools, again, instruments for sewing the robes. They will dye the robes very neatly so that the robes are a nice color. Okay, so if the Buddha's disciples honored him because he wears cloth, a robe of any kind, then they should honor instead not the Buddha, but those disciples who follow very strictly these austere practices of making the vow, the resolution, only to wear robes made from cast-off pieces of cloth. Okay, then the third place the Buddha takes up Udayi's thought that the Buddha's disciples respect and honor him because the Buddha is content with any kind of alms food and praises contentment with any kind of alms food. And now the Buddha points out if that is the case, then his disciples should give first place not to him, but they should take as the supreme teacher some of his other disciples who carry through more rigorously the ascetic practices regarding alms food. The Buddha says that he has disciples who make the vow, the resolution, to take food only, to eat only food that they collect on alms round. These are the ones that are called alms food eaters. That is, they refuse to accept any food, to accept any invitations to go to houses for meals, or to accept food that people will prepare in advance and then bring to the monastery. Venerable Mahakasapa was very famous for observing this ascetic practice. And then there are others who are not only make this resolve to go only an alms round, but they go on the unbroken or uninterrupted alms round. That is, they will go from house to house without any discrimination. Even if they get no food, maybe sometimes they go the same area, go to the same set of houses, year after year, the same house is never given, but every time they go to that area, they will stop at that house, wait a few minutes, and then pass on. And there's a famous story that comes in the opening of a work called the Melinda Panha. There is a monk named Nagasena. He is the one who will be the main... The questions of King Melinda, Melinda Panha, is a dialogue between the monk Nagasena and a king named King Melinda. It's a kind of fictional dialogue which has become a classic of Buddhist literature. And there was one at the opening of the work, there is one monk, you see, the person who was to become the monk Nagasena had been a deva, a deity, who is reborn into a certain house and had made a vow earlier to become a great Buddhist monk who will convert a certain king to Buddhism. And now there's another monk after his rebirth who knows that he has taken rebirth in the family of a Brahmin. And this monk's task is to find this young boy and bring him into the Sangha. But the boy has been reborn into a home, a family of Brahmins who are very hostile to Buddhism. So he has to get an opening into that family. So this monk who's charged to get him goes, every day he goes on uninterrupted alms round. He passes by that house, waits for the people to come to offer alms, but the people never speak to him. And this goes on for 7 years. Till the boy is 7 years old, they never speak to him. Then one time, when he's on alms round, okay, the husband is not home, but the wife is outside, maybe working in the garden. He goes by on alms round, and the wife says to him, "Please pass on, Venerable Sir. We don't give to the Buddhists." And so he passes on, and then he sees, sometime later, he sees the husband, the Brahmin, is walking back to his home. And he sees the husband coming, and he says to the husband, "Please thank your wife, she was very kind to me today." And so when the husband comes home, he says to his wife, "Did you give some food to that beggar, that outcast beggar?" And she says, "I gave nothing to him." So then the husband says, "Then why did he thank me and say that you were very kind to him today?" Then the wife says, "All I did, he came on his regular alms round, and all I did today was to say to him, 'Please pass on, Venerable Sir, we're not giving anything today.'" So then the husband thought, "This is very strange. The next day, I'll ask when he comes on alms round, I'll ask him what he meant by this, why he thanked me." Okay, so then the next day, the monk came on alms round. The Brahmin was waiting. When he saw the monk, he came out and he said, "Excuse me, but yesterday you thanked me and you said that your wife, you asked me to thank your wife and you said that my wife is very kind to you. But when I came home, I asked my wife if she gave you anything and she said that she gave you nothing." Then the monk said, "Oh, but your wife did give me something. she spoke, for the first time in 7 years, she spoke some kind words to me and said, please pass on. Then the Brahmin thought, it seems that these monks are very, very cultured people, since even if they get no offerings, but just for getting kind words, they express thanks. Then when he heard this, when he reflected upon this, then he thought, perhaps I should give this monk some alms food. And so then he instructed his wife to give alms food to the monk, and they started giving food regularly to the monk. And then in time, the monk got to know this family well, came to know their son, and by getting to know the son, then he was able to lead that son to Buddhism and make him in time a Buddhist monk. Okay, so this is the uninterrupted alms round. Well, the Buddha says, he, in contrast, he accepts invitations to meals. Often people will come to the Buddha or come to the monastery, they'll say, please, Venerable Sir, accept our invitation to come to our home tomorrow or on such and such a date, and bring so many monks with you, and we will provide you with your meal for the day. And when they invite him, then they will serve very fine quality rice and with various sauces and curries. And so those disciples who go on regular alms round, they often get very poor food. Where the Buddha, because he accepts invitations, he will often get very high quality food. Okay, then fourth is the resting place or lodging. If the Buddha's disciples respected and honored him because the Buddha is content with any kind of resting place, then it would follow that they should respect most highly some of his other disciples who live under much more austere, much more demanding conditions than the Buddha does. Okay, these are some of the other ascetic practices regarding dwelling. There are disciples who can make the resolution that they will not live under a roof for 8 months of the year, that is, those months apart from the rainy season. During the rainy season, one has to live under a roof. And according to the Manat, this is a rule within the Vinaya, the monastic code. One has to live within a sheltered dwelling. But during the other months, when it's dry, one could live under any conditions. And so during that period, there will be disciples who make the resolution to observe these ascetic practices. Some will make the resolve, the vow, to live at the root of a tree. So they'll choose, they'll move from place to place and they'll select different trees. It's not always the same tree. But they will live only at the roots of a tree. And there are these trees in India which have these big expanding roots and large shaded tops. And so one could dwell quite securely there. And the top of the tree will provide adequate shelter. And so they will spread a mat there, or extra robe, and use it for lying down. And then they don't have to worry about sweeping, mopping, putting things away. But they live there as long as they want. When they want to move on, they just roll up all of their belongings, which they can generally fit in a in his shoulder bag and just move on till they find another comfortable tree and stay there. There are other disciples who live only in the open air. That's even more difficult than living under a tree, since one doesn't have any overhead shelter to provide shade. Some disciples will live, one of the ascetic practices is to dwell in cremation ground or cemetery. Another practice is to be content with any dwelling, no matter where one winds up. One will not have a fixed dwelling place. This is my monastery, my temple, my room, but one will move from place to place constantly throughout the year, and wherever one winds up, there one will spend the night. Then the next day one picks up one's belongings and moves on till one finds oneself at a place the next night. There one spends the night, then one moves on the next day. Okay. But the Buddha, in contrast, sometimes lives in, people will offer him gabled mansions that have been plastered inside and outside, that are protected against the wind. They have doors secured by bolts and shuttered windows. In India, in that time, they didn't have glass windows, but there would be the windows with wooden panes, wooden shutters that one opens during the day so the breeze could come in, and at night one closes. So if the Buddha's disciples honored him because the Buddha lives under austere conditions, then they should give first place to those disciples who are practicing the Dutangas, the austere practices regarding dwellings, not to the Buddha himself. Okay, then the Buddha says the fifth reason that Udayi gives, he takes up for refutation or to reply to. He says, if my disciples honored me because I prefer to live in seclusion, then there are other disciples of mine who live under much more secluded conditions than I do. Okay, these are some of the other ascetic practices. Okay, there are some, one ascetic practice is to take the vow of dwelling in a, only in a forest. One makes a vow not to dwell in a temple or monastery located within the boundaries of a village, a town, or a city. If one has to come into a city or a town for any reason, one comes in during the day, but at the time the sun sets, one has to be out of the town or city, and one has to be in the forest for the night. And so these, those disciples who make this vow, many of them will have small monasteries in the forest where they will live together. But there are others who make the vow not to live even in a monastery in the forest, but to live in complete seclusion in the forest. They will just live on their own, but they will come together with other monks once each half month for the recitation of the Patimokkha, for the performance of the what's called the Uposatha Kamma, that is the monastic ritual of reciting the rules of the order every 2 weeks. Okay, but while there are some disciples who live in such secluded conditions, the Buddha himself says, I often live surrounded by bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, as monks and nuns, by men and women lay followers, by kings, he has kings who are his disciples, by kings' ministers, by the teachers of other sects and their disciples. So if the Buddha's disciples honored him because he lives a secluded way of life, then they should think that the Buddha is just living the life of enjoyment and self-indulgence. Even you could say he's hobnobbing with kings and royal ministers. Whereas these other disciples of his are so withdrawn, so secluded, that they will just keep aloof from everybody, except once every 2 weeks they come together with other monks to recite the rules of the order. Okay, so now, having rejected these five reasons as being the valid reasons why his disciples honor him, the Buddha now goes on to explain, in paragraph 10, he starts to explain five other qualities because of which his disciples honor, respect, and venerate him. Okay, so these are from the Buddha's own standpoint the five real reasons for respecting him. First, the Buddha's disciples esteem him because he observes what is called the higher virtue or higher moral discipline. And for a very detailed account of the Buddha's moral discipline, moral virtue, you can look at the first discourse in the Digha Nikaya, the Brahmajala Sutta. But in that sutta, the Buddha says that one who exclusively respects and reveres the Buddha because of his moral discipline, that is an ordinary person, an unenlightened person. That is not the true or ultimate reason for venerating the Buddha. The Buddha says it's only the ordinary or worldly person. Fufanren? Fufanren, is that the Chinese? The ordinary person. It is just the ordinary person who will completely respect and venerate the Buddha exclusively because of his moral discipline. But one who has true wisdom will respect and venerate the Buddha for his other qualities. Okay, some of these other qualities now, we come in number two. The disciples respect and revere him because of his excellent knowledge and vision. Okay, so that when the Buddha says, I know, he truly knows. When he says, I see, he truly sees. And the recluse Gotama teaches the Dhamma through direct knowledge, not direct knowledge. That is, he teaches the Dhamma based upon his own personal insight into the truth of the teaching, not based upon inference, reasoning, the authority of others, not because he has accepted some tradition that has come down from ancient times, the way the Brahmins do. He teaches the Dhamma with a sound basis. That is, he teaches a Dhamma based upon causal grounds. That is, he has a Dhamma which he sees into through the basis of cause and condition. And he gives himself, when he teaches the Dhamma, he gives reasons and conditions for the principles that he teaches. And then he teaches the Dhamma in a convincing manner, not in an unconvincing manner. according to the commentary, this is in a sense an extension of reason number two, that he teaches with a sound basis, and that the Buddha uses similes, analogies, illustrations, which help to convey the truth of his teaching. What I found rather curious and puzzling in the sutta is when the Buddha is describing the way his disciples honor him, he quotes them as speaking, and he says, when he's quoting the way they might speak, they say, when the recluse Gotama says, I know, he truly knows, and so on, the recluse Gotama teaches the Dhamma. They're always speaking about the recluse Gotama, but that is not the way the Buddha's own disciples regularly speak about him. They regularly speak about him as the Blessed One, Bhagava. And I think what has happened here and the way this sutta has been transmitted, earlier the Buddha was speaking about the way Sakaludayi would phrase his thoughts about the Buddha. And then Sakaludayi, of course, would phrase them in terms of the recluse Gotama. And so it seems that that has carried through in the process of transmission through the way the Buddha himself is speaking about his disciples. So instead of reformulating this in terms of Bhagava, the Blessed One, that habit of speaking about the recluse Gotama has carried through, and it's now being attributed to the way the Buddha's disciples speak about him. But it seems the correct way it should be formulated is in terms of Bhagava, or Blessed One. Okay, coming now, reason number three. And here I have to make some change in the translation. Okay. Again, Udayi, my disciples esteem me for the higher wisdom. Thus, the recluse Gotama is wise. He possesses the supreme aggregate of wisdom. Okay, this is something a little bit different from this excellent knowledge and vision. Often knowledge and vision is used in the text almost as a synonym for wisdom, but it seems in this sutta, knowledge and vision is used to mean the basis for teaching, having knowledge and vision into the Dhamma as a basis for teaching and communicating the truth. But here also wisdom is used not so much to mean the Buddha's own understanding of the truth insofar as it has an impact upon the Buddha's own liberation, but again, the Buddha's wisdom insofar it qualifies him as a teacher. But let me continue. Okay, the recluse Gotama is wise. He possesses the supreme aggregate of wisdom. Now, here's where I make the change. What's printed in the text here, it is impossible that he should not foresee the future courses of doctrine. And then the note, which I wrote, says, what's in the note is correct, except for the last sentence, that the Buddha, the phrase may also imply that the Buddha has laid down a critique applicable to any doctrine that might arise in the future course of religious and philosophical thought. Now, the way I understand this phrase, it doesn't quite have that implication. But rather, I would now translate it, it is impossible that he should not foresee the future implications of an assertion. And the way we should understand this is that this is based upon the commentary, which here I think is quite correct, that when the Buddha is engaged in a debate or an argument with some opponent, and the Buddha himself makes an assertion, it's impossible that he doesn't see all of the possible consequences of his own assertion. Such that some other opponent, would be able to draw out some implication from the Buddha's assertion and use that as a basis for refuting the Buddha's doctrine. Okay, so it's impossible that he should not foresee the future, or let's say the unexpressed implications of an assertion, or that he should not be able to confute with reasons the current doctrines of others. And then there comes the sentences that follow, a little bit of an aside, or say almost like a footnote here. He says, "What do you think, Udayi? Would my disciples, knowing and seeing thus, break in and interrupt me?" Then the Buddha says, "I do not expect instruction from my disciples. Invariably, it is my disciples who expect instruction from me." The point here is that, again, this is from the commentary, that when the Buddha is engaged in a discussion or debate with somebody, the Buddha is able to handle the opponent on his own. It's not like some of these famous teachers of the Buddha's time, when they get involved in the debate, sometimes they get trapped, pushed into a corner with the argument. Then they have to turn to a disciple and say, "How do we get out of this? How do we get out of this corner?" And then the disciple will have to give them some hint. "Why don't you argue in this way?" It's a little bit like playing chess, where you get into a position of check and you have to turn to a friend. "How do we get out of this cul-de-sac?" And then the friend has to suggest a strategy for getting out of the difficulty. But the Buddha is able to handle the arguments all on his own. He doesn't need help from his disciples. Okay, then we come to the fourth reason. And this seems to emphasize or to highlight the really practical orientation of the Buddha's teaching. That the teaching is not given exclusively for the purpose, or it's not given at all for the purpose of simply propounding a philosophical doctrine, for setting up a position in order to argue and to win in debates, but it's a teaching that's set forth in order to show the way to liberation from suffering. So the Buddha says, "When my disciples have met with suffering, become victims of suffering, or prey to suffering, they come to me and ask me about the noble truth of suffering. And being asked, I explain to them, this is the noble truth of suffering. And I satisfy their minds with my explanation. Or they come and they ask me about the noble truth of the origin of suffering, and I explain to them the origin of suffering, and I satisfy their minds with my explanation. Or they come and they ask about the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. Again, I explain the cessation of suffering. They come and they ask about the noble truth of the way to the cessation of suffering. I explain the way to the cessation of suffering, and I satisfy their minds with my explanation. Okay, so this is the fourth quality because of which my disciples honor him. And then I would have to say it's not simply because the Buddha teaches a particularly very intricate and tightly knit doctrine, but they honor him because he teaches the true way to liberation from suffering. So for this reason, the Buddha was able to attract people from many different walks of life to his teaching. Not only people inclined to an ascetic way of life, but people from every dimension of human life. Okay, the fifth category is given the heading, the way to develop wholesome states. And this category is used as a kind of, I call it an umbrella category for including all the different aspects of the Buddha's teaching. I believe in the Chinese, the version of this sutta preserved in the Chinese Tripitaka, this sutta, or this part of the sutta, it's much, much more concise. It has just that the Buddha teaches the way to recollect previous lives and the way to the extinction of the defilements. And perhaps that was the more archaic version of this section. But within the Pali tradition, that particular section became used as a heading for including all the different aspects of the teaching that pertain to the path to liberation. And so the first general category that comes within this way to develop wholesome states is the very broad category that are called the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, 37 aids to enlightenment. And these 37 aids to enlightenment fall into seven groups. Each group has a different number of factors. So the first group consists of the four foundations of mindfulness, the four establishments of mindfulness. That is the contemplation of the body, contemplation of feelings, contemplation of mind, contemplation of mind objects. Okay, these we explored quite recently when we discussed the Satipatthana Sutta, so I don't have to go through these in any detail. Okay, the next set that we come to are called the four right, here I call them the four right kinds of striving. They might also be called the four right efforts. This is actually an elaboration of the right effort factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. So what are these four right kinds of striving or four right efforts? here a bhikkhu, a monk, awakens zeal or desire for the non-arising of unarisen, evil, unwholesome states, or states of mind. He makes an effort, arouses energy, exerts his mind, and strives. So all of these words here, all of these terms are describing different ways of applying, arousing, or applying energy. And this energy is being used in the first instance to prevent evil, bad, unwholesome qualities of mind from arising. The second right application of effort, right kind of striving, is to make the effort to abandon evil, unwholesome states that have already arisen. When unwholesome states of mind arise, states of greed, states of anger or ill will, states of delusion, or any of the other defiled states, one applies energy to abandon them, to remove them. The third, one awakens zeal, or I prefer now to say one arouses desire for the arising of unarisen wholesome states. That is, one has to make the effort to bring into being, to arouse, to awaken wholesome states of mind, good states of mind that have not yet arisen. What's mentioned especially here is to bring into being the seven factors of enlightenment, or to bring into being the four foundations of mindfulness, any states, any good, pure, wholesome states of mind have to be aroused, brought into being. And then the fourth right effort is the effort when these good, pure, wholesome mental states have come into being, one makes the effort to maintain them, the effort to sustain them, to prevent them from fading away, the effort to strengthen them, to increase them, and to bring them to full maturity, to fullness of development. These four right efforts are called, technically we have names for them. I'll put the Pali words on the board, then explain them. Okay, the first is called Sangvara Padana. This means the effort, to restrain. That is, the effort to restrain the mind so that the unarisen, unwholesome states don't arise. And this is said to be practiced especially through the restraint of the senses. That is, one guards the sense faculties so that the mind doesn't go out through the senses seeking enjoyable, beautiful objects with the senses to become attracted to, and that through the senses one doesn't become upset or disturbed by disagreeable objects. The second is called Pahana Padana, the effort to abandon or the effort to overcome. That is the effort to abandon the arisen unwholesome state. So that whenever the thoughts of greed, sensuality, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of harming arise in the mind, one doesn't tolerate them, but one expels them from the mind. Thoughts of pride, thoughts of anger, any kind of unwholesome thought, one expels and overcomes. The third right effort, bhavana padana, this is the effort to bring into being, the effort to develop, to cultivate wholesome states, good states that have not yet arisen. So whenever one undertakes any kind of wholesome practices, observing precepts, developing any kind of meditation subject, studying the Dharma, one is developing, arousing wholesome mental states. This applies especially, as I said before, to bringing into being the seven factors of enlightenment, especially that begins with undertaking the practice of satipatthana, developing one of the foundations of mindfulness. And then the fourth right effort, anurakkhana padana, is the effort to maintain or to sustain. That is, with this effort, one protects the wholesome states that have arisen. One maintains them, protects them, so that they can increase and come to maturity. One doesn't allow them to deteriorate. And it's said that this is undertaken especially when one gains favorable object of samadhi, favorable object of concentration. Maybe this is too limited a sense, but this is what is mentioned in the text. Then one very carefully maintains that object of concentration so that one can mature the mind until it reaches full concentration. Okay, I will continue next week explaining the other factors that are included within the aids to enlightenment. If there are any questions.
The second, third, and fourth quality. It's talking about being content with any kind of growth, and I'm not sure why counter that would be, well, this guy is not content with nice clothes, he's only content with
coarse
robes. Like, I would think saying content with any sort of covers all bases.
There's actually an analysis of contentment with any kind of robe. It comes in the commentaries, which analyzes three classes of contentment with any kind of robe. One class is, I think this is considered like the supreme contentment with any kind of robe, is in a way you aren't really content with any kind of robe, but you make the special determination to wear only the robe that is made from cast off pieces of cloth.
So that's regarded as a form of contentment.
Yeah, that is considered like the supreme example of contentment, because you show that one is willing to use the things that are considered very low and the utmost simplicity, rejecting any sign of luxury, any kind of concession to... Okay, the second class of contentment is that one accepts whatever is given, whether it be good quality, poor quality, one doesn't have any discrimination. The third is that one is content with whatever suits one's capacity. This is might be in the case of, say, in the case of a robe, there might be a monk who's very sensitive, say, to cold, so he has to use a thicker robe. So he'll be content with any kind of thick robe, any kind of robe that's thick, because he's sensitive to cold. If he's living in a cold climate, it has to be a somewhat thick robe, otherwise he'll not be able to endure. But whether it's a good quality, poor quality, good quality, poor quality, he doesn't discriminate, as long as the robe is somewhat thick, so that he doesn't suffer from the cold. Similarly, especially with food, there might be monks who are have maybe allergies to certain foods, that they can't take these foods, or have certain dietary requirements for health reasons, so they need certain foods. But within those limits, they will be content with whatever they receive. Okay, I think, but one has to understand this against the ascetic way of life in India in the Buddha's time, where was the general ideal to be wearing robes made from pieces of cloth that one finds and sews together. And so for the Buddha to allow monks to receive robes that are made by householders and for himself to wear robes given by householders, that was considered a great concession, a compromise with the very rugged and austere ascetic way of life that was common amongst in the ascetic communities of that time.
The 37 days to enlightenment, is that being a prominent place in Buddhist culture?
In Buddhist doctrine, very, very prominent. Because the Buddha does emphasize them in some of his discourses shortly before his passing away. He's come in the Digha Nikaya, I think also in the Majjhima Nikaya, I think it's sutra number 103. He says to the monks, "These are the teachings which I have taught to you on the basis of my own direct knowledge. You should meet together often and rehearse these, recite these, undertake them, practice them, and bring them to fullness of development." And so this was a way that the Buddha summed up the teachings that he gave throughout his teaching career. But what's interesting is that within the canon itself, the Nikayas, we don't find the expression by which these 37 practices come to be known through Buddhist tradition. We don't find the expression Bodhipakkhya Dhammas applied to these 37 states. We find the expression Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, but I think within the canon they are applied, that expression is applied only to the seven factors of enlightenment. Or maybe it's applied to different groups of factors, but not to all 37 together. But from a very early period, right up to the present, that comes to be the general category under which these are, the general designation for these 37 states.
You have the question?
Sutta number one in the Digha Nikaya. It's the Brahmajala Sutta. Just a few days ago, somebody asked me, I don't remember who, whether it would be all right for the monks play chess. And I said, well, I don't know any specific vinaya rule against it, but if you look in the Brahmajala Sutta, under the detailed description of the higher virtue, you find that it's said that the Buddha, that it's also said in the Samanyatthala Sutta, in the, describing the ideal conduct of the monk, that when he goes forth from the household life into homelessness, he doesn't play games on boards made up into squares. Any further questions? Okay, then we'll stop for the night and we'll end with the sharing of the merits.
Akasata Chabumata Devanaga Mahitika Punyantam Anumoditva Chiram Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabumata Devanaga Mahitika Punyantam Anumoditva Chirang rakantu desanam Akasata chabumata Devanaga mahitika Punyantam anumoditva Chirang rakantu mangkaram Etavata cha amhehi sampadam punya sampadam Sabe deva numodantu Sabha sampati siddhya Etavata cha amhehi sampadam punya sampadam Sabe bhuta anumodantu Sabha sampati siddhya Etavata cha amhehi sampadam punya sampadam Sabbe sattha numodantu Sabba sampatti siddhya.